Relationships all have their complexities, but if one partner is living with a disability, it can add an extra layer. For some people in this situation, yes, the practicalities of life together take some added thought, but the real problem is often other people's assumptions about the balance of care in their relationship. This is the second episode in the new series on disability and relationships by producer Eliza Hull, who is herself a person with a disability. She has a neurological condition known as Charcot-Marie tooth disorder.
I'm in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, where I've come to speak to a couple, Nicole and Mark, in their home that they share with their cats.
Hey, I'm Eliza. Hey, nice to meet you.
Nicole and Mark have been together for 3 years. Nicole has a physical disability and is a wheelchair user. Mark does not have a disability.
Yeah, well, we met on Tinder, of all places.
I don't think either of us were really ready for anything serious at the time, but it just kind of developed from there.
Nicole didn't tell Mark straight away that she had a disability.
Yeah, when we first met on Tinder and we started chatting, I didn't have anything that identified that I had a disability up on Tinder, because I'd gotten a bit of sort of negative responses from people. So I remember having to say to you, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm in a wheelchair. And the awkward response that I got back, do you remember that?
Yeah, well, it was a surprise. I wasn't expecting it. And then it was more just, I hadn't really had any experience with anyone in a wheelchair, like any friends or anything, so I didn't really know what to expect at all.
Yeah, so I was really, really close to telling him to get lost, because I'd had a lot of that response from Tinder. So I thought, no, I'll be nice. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, so it was helpful that you were able to, you know, answer questions and just make me feel more at ease with it. But I guess that might be something that you get kind of sick of, trying to put people at ease.
What do you think are the greatest misconceptions that you've faced as a couple?
People thinking that I'm caring for Nicole, that I'm her carer. She's very independent. She's probably more independent than me with everything that she does.
Oh, I've had one person say, you know, you're really lucky to have Mark. I've had that happen once.
That is true, though.
Yeah, I'll take that.
What about for you? I mean, do you notice that Nicole gets treated differently when you're out at a cafe or you're out somewhere?
Sometimes people will talk to me instead of Nicole. Like if we're ordering at a counter at a cafe or something, and then they'll address me, and I just sometimes I forget, and I just, because they talk to me, I'll talk back. But I'm trying to be more aware of it.
Some of these misconceptions that Nicole and Mark have faced as a couple, they are trying to demystify, especially that Mark is Nicole's carer.
Like, I'll help get a chair in and out of the car, but not like, it's things that she can do herself. She's got support workers to help with things that she can't do.
I don't want to be reliant on Mark, and I'm very, very adamant with that with the NDIS, in that when they go looking for informal supports, is that I don't want to be in a position where I'm physically reliant on anyone other than a support worker to do my day-to-day things and to stay independent in my house.
Nicole feels very strongly about this because of her past relationship experiences.
For 10 years I was abused by my ex-husband, who was my carer, and that involved, you know, physical, financial, emotional and sexual abuse that went for 10 years. And so the dynamic of being massively stuck was an understatement. I remember the police saying, you know, we actually didn't think we'd ever get you out, and you were more stuck than anyone else that I've had to work with. It left me in a position where I didn't think that I could leave, and I didn't think I could survive without having this person here. And even though we were unhappy and it was violent and I wanted to leave, I didn't think that I could, because I didn't think, you know, violence also, you know, is very isolating, and you already feel very stuck in that situation anyway. And then you put disability on top of it and it makes it, you know, 10 times, 100 times worse.
Nicole is now an advocate for disability rights in the prevention of family violence.
I think it's a lot of, it's just not fair. We are entitled, we are allowed to have independence if we want it. And to keep pushing us into these positions where we have to ask people around us to do us, it's taking away our independence and it's taking away our rights to have everyday relationships.
I'm now in a lift going up to speak to another couple, this time in their apartment in the inner city of Melbourne. Alistair and Brandon are a same-sex couple. Alistair has a physical disability and uses leg braces. Brandon does not have a disability.
Like before I met Brandon, like I would be like on Tinder or other apps. And sometimes, like I would sometimes have like a picture of me cropped like with the leg braces and without the leg braces. And it was just sort of astounding how better the responses were when the leg braces were cropped out. I think before people have like a connection with you, they only see their like preconceptions about disability, and they don't necessarily see that like I am like funny or nice.
Before meeting Alistair, Brandon had never been in a relationship with someone with a disability.
I guess I did have assumptions, and no, it's completely changed what I thought. But not that I thought badly anyway. But, you know, he's just a person. And that's really, everybody's just a person.
Has having a disability added any complexity to your relationship?
I think maybe sometimes, because my energy levels are a bit lower, you know, Brandon would prefer to do more stuff or go out more, and I'm like, I'm tired.
Most of the challenges, though, have happened through societal attitudes.
People, like, will assume that, like, Brandon's, like, a good person for being with me. Like, I'm, like, a sort of charity case. We got, a couple of months ago, this, like, guy driving a truck yelled out poofters at us because we were holding hands. And I was, like, angry about that. But there was a part of me that was, like, sort of pleased that he did recognise us as a gay couple. We sort of get weirdly shielded from some homophobia. Sometimes people think that, like, when we're holding hands, Brandon's a medical professional who's teaching me to walk again after a jet ski accident, which is how we met, but it's so much more than that now. That's not how we met, that was it. Because he'll help me up steps and down steps and stuff like that. And
Brandon also helps Alistair with lifting, opening up jars, cooking and driving.
It's just bizarre to me that you could think that caring would work against a relationship rather than like being like one of the ways that you actually show people love. Every relationship has, you know, a back and forth and exchange of caring, and, you know, someone has to cook for the other person each night, and maybe that leans more towards him than it does towards me, but that doesn't mean that, you know, he's growing with resentment.
Alistair believes society still has a long way to go in how we view people with disabilities in relationships.
People perceive disabled people as not having a sexuality, let alone one of the abnormal ones as deemed by society. I think disability, there's still a little while to go to show, like, you know, positive relationships between disabled people, between disabled people and abled people. It's 2019, I'm disabled, Brandon's mixed race, I'm gay, he's bisexual, I'm disabled. It's just the way things are.
I'm now in central Victoria, where couple Andy and Rachel live together in their quaint cottage home. Their house is surrounded by birds and native trees. They reflect on how they met.
We were mid-30s, so I think at that stage, I actually had not been in a relationship before, so it really felt like, on one level, I was becoming maybe reconcile to the fact that maybe I would be single. And so on one level, I kind of let go of that possibility.
I thought you were really intriguing and I really enjoyed our conversation. And I went home and read some of your poetry and was bowled away by it, so I boldly emailed.
Andy is a poet and has Marfan syndrome. A symptom of this is significant curvature of the spine. What did you think about Andy when you met him, and did you notice, you know, that he had a visible difference?
I think what struck me first was Andy's appearance, and what struck me very powerfully next was his sense of countenance and grace and the way he inhabited his body. So I think I found that very magnetic. One of the peculiar things I've had to grapple with in this relationship is with your visibility, I've acquired a invisibility, and often people don't recognise me when I'm not with Andy because Andy's so striking.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably a very strange experience, whereas for me, I've always been kind of quote-unquote famous. So, I think the other thing that happened for us was I've always had people maybe staring or saying things or, you know, just treating me really oddly now and then, actually pretty regularly. But I think especially in the early stages of the relationship, I think that was kind of hard for you to, I guess, deal with, or the realisation that other people were doing that.
But it has taken time for Rachel to get used to how society interacts with Andy's visible difference.
I felt constantly sort of astonished and outraged at how hostile and intrusive people's staring and attitudes were. So I started to sort of stare people down if I caught them looking at Andy, or turn to face them if they said something abusive, or I just couldn't believe it. And then eventually I almost had to learn, I suppose as you have, Andy, to ignore the stares and to not tune into them.
The biggest challenge for Rachel, though, was her family's initial judgment of her relationship with Andy.
My family were incredibly disappointing initially, and it was quite traumatic. My mother has had a sort of has been very prejudiced about difference, so she was appalled and horrified and behaved like I'd sort of brought potential shame upon the family. And my father went into a sort of awful, he was, you know, kind of assumed that I'd taken the role of a carer, and he couldn't understand why I'd encumbered myself by choosing to be someone's carer. And over time, their attitudes have really shifted.
People often don't realise that Rachel has a disability, one that is invisible.
I guess perhaps looking at us, people would at first assume that Andy's the one with chronic pain. But in fact, I have chronic disabling pain. I have almost felt disingenuous declaring that I have pain because I guess I'm acutely aware of the assumptions people might carry.
Rachel has fibromyalgia and a hereditary muscle disorder.
Andy is the carer in this relationship because there are times when I am very incapacitated, both mentally and physically.
Oh, every relationship involves care, you know, and more or less at different times, and it shifts to and fro. And even if I'm at times perhaps kind of on some level doing more of the quote-unquote care, it's still... there's still some caring going both ways.
That's Andy, a man who has a visible difference, and he was speaking along with his partner Rachel. And before him you heard from Alastair Baldwin and his partner Brandon Danker, and Nicole Lee and her partner Marcus Holloway. And that was the second episode in the series created by Eliza Hull on disability and relationships. Next Monday we'll hear the final episode featuring people who are in relationships where both partners have a disability of some kind. That's here on Life Matters.